Hello, my name's Dave Embry, and in the next half hour, we're going to update a series that I've been doing for a couple of years now, and it's one that I believe is as important as anything I've ever done. That's not in any way to be egotistical, but I think the German corporate control over American publishing is likely to prove to be a decisive element in human affairs on this planet. What educated Americans are going to know about the world, World War II, etc., is going to come from German corporations with apparent links to the Bormann Group and what I call the Underground Reich. Without wasting any of our precious and valuable time, we're going to get right down to that update. The main corporation that I've dealt with in the context of not only German corporate control over American publishing, but in the background of that Underground Reich control over American publishing, is the Bertelsmann firm. That is a huge media conglomerate, the third largest media corporation in the world, and one that has effective control over American publishing, and along with the von Holtzbrinck firm, has almost complete control over American publishing. Bertelsmann, as I've noted in For the Record segment 177, also has profound influence in the American music business. As discussed in this article that we're going to touch on briefly, this is from the front page of the business section of the Los Angeles Times from December 21st of 1999. This is an article by Chuck Phillips. It's headlined, "Discord with Record Labels Threatens BMG's Big Moment." This refers to some disputes within the firm, some of which, since this article was written, have already been settled. But note that at least for the time being, Bertelsmann has assumed a profound position, a very dominant position, in American music distribution. It doesn't get much better than it got this week for Bertelsmann Music Group. BMG, a division of German media giant Bertelsmann, rules the music sales chart with 6 of the 10 top-selling albums in the nation and commands 19% of the U.S. market. Bear in mind that this firm has very apparent connections to what I call the Underground Reich and the Bormann Group. The role of Reinhard Mohn in shoehorning one of his proteges, Dieter Vogel, into the top position at the Thyssen Industrial Group, one of the most important elements in German heavy industry and one of the most important elements in the Bormann mosaic as well, is one of the indicators of this firm's significance to the Bormann Group and the Underground Reich. I would also note that Heinrich Mohn, his father and the patron, the main man involved with the development of that company, was SS, as we looked at in For the Record segment 123. What we're going to do now is, and I would note also that the profound role of Bertelsmann in American music publishing as well. We're going to touch briefly on the book Serpent's Walk later on in this broadcast. That book is about a Nazi takeover in the 21st century after the SS go underground, build up a huge capital organization, and buy into and gain control of the American opinion-forming media. Obviously, for educated Americans, publishing is a key element of the opinion-forming media. And for uneducated Americans, what they're going to be learning about is going to come from educated Americans. And what they're going to be learning, what they're going to know about World War II, fascism, etc., is going to come from people like Bertelsmann and von Holtzbrinck, or institutions like Bertelsmann and von Holtzbrinck. Bertelsmann's influence in American publishing continues to expand. The New York Times of Tuesday, December 14th of 1999, has the following story by Doreen Carvajal, C-A-R-V-A-J-A-L, I may be mispronouncing the name. It's headlined, "Two book club giants are said to be poised to join forces." Less than a year and a half after buying the nation's premier publishing house, the Bertelsmann media conglomerate is poised to form a partnership with an American icon of popular literature, the Book of the Month Club unit of Time Incorporated. Bertelsmann, which is based in Gütersloh, Germany, and purchased Random House last year, is negotiating to create a joint venture that could bring together the two largest book clubs in the United States, the Book of the Month Club and Bertelsmann's Literary Guild, according to publishing executives who insist on remaining anonymous. So apparently now the Bertelsmann Literary Guild will be merging with Time Incorporated's Book of the Month Club, giving Bertelsmann still greater influence in the American publishing industry, something they already wield profound influence in. Bear in mind that they controlled Bantam, Doubleday, Dell. Then they bought Random House, which the year before Bertelsmann purchased it, had more than double the sales volume of any other English language publisher. And note that there are disturbing indications that Bertelsmann, despite all of its elaborate pretenses to the contrary, like all major German corporations, first of all, it has profound links to the Bormann Group, and what the Bormann Group is can be determined from numerous other programs, including the other programs about this particular subject. For the record, segment 122, 123, and 177, as well as 152, the first side anyway, go into the Bormann Group, and that'll give you some perspective on that. I would note in the recent debate about compensating slave labor victims of the German corporations during World War II, there was a great deal of acrimony on both sides, with German corporations resisting the compensations to a certain extent, and with the people on the other side, the plaintiffs, expressing grave dissatisfaction with the German recalcitrance under the circumstances. An article about that was carried in the Financial Times of December 18th and 19th of 1999. This article is by Hague Simonian in Berlin, and it's headlined, Fears Mar German Deal on War Victim Payments, and it reads in part as follows. The celebrations yesterday to mark formal agreement on a $10 billion Deutschmark or $5.2 billion settlement to compensate Nazi-era forced and slave laborers were overshadowed by fears that German companies may stumble in meeting their $5 billion Deutschmark share. And skipping down, there is discussion by Manfred Gentz, the finance director of Daimler Chrysler, about some of the companies that have been unwilling or reluctant to participate in this fund. He highlighted the powerful media sector, which he said had been, quote, astonishingly reluctant, unquote, to contribute. The largest German media firm, of course, is Bertelsmann, which was the largest publisher of books for the Wehrmacht and SS in World War II. And again, the patron, the main man of that firm at that time, Heinrich Mohn, was SS. What we're going to do next is to take a look at yet another indication that Bertelsmann is connected with the Bormann Group. And we've discussed that at considerable length in other programs. Again, a Reinhard Mohn protege, Dieter Vogel, was shoehorned into the top position at the Thyssen Group. The Thyssen Group, one of the main elements in the Bormann tiara, so to speak, and that in and of itself is indicative of the profound influence of Bertelsmann and its people with the Bormann organization. The importance of the Thyssen firm to German heavy industry could not be exaggerated. We're going to take a look now at the landmark text, the definitive text about the Bormann Group. This is authored, of course, by Paul Manning, a man whose work we've dealt with in the past. Paul Manning was part of the CBS News team that covered World War II in Europe, along with Edward R. Murrow. He trained as a waste gunner in a B-17 in order to cover the air war in Europe, was credited with shooting down an ME-109. He then trained as a nose gunner in a B-29 in order to cover the air war in Japan after the cessation of hostilities in Europe. It was Paul Manning who broadcast the surrenders of Japan and Germany to the American people on the CBS radio network, the only broadcaster to broadcast both surrenders. After World War II, utilizing, among other things, his friendship with Alan Dulles, Paul Manning began exploring the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, which initially was the focal point of an Allied intelligence operation called Operation Safe Haven. And at great expense and cost to his career, Paul Manning heroically and successfully got this story about the Bormann Group into print, despite the fact that the representatives of the Thyssen firm forced the cancellation of his original contract with Doubleday. I would note also that the publisher of Lyle Stewart, whose publishing firm carries his name, had his legs broken the week of publication. And I would also note that in the early 90s, Jerry Manning, Paul Manning's son, was murdered as Paul Manning was preparing to publish another book called In Search of Martin Bormann. And according to Paul Manning's intelligence sources, that was basically it was retribution for his work on the Bormann Group. The definitive text on the Bormann Group is called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. It was authored by Paul Manning and eventually was read by Martin Bormann himself, who responded to Paul Manning through intermediaries, saying it was a good book, but you won't profit from it or gain any professional success from it. That turned out to be very, very accurate indeed. The Manning family suffered a lot because of the work that he was doing on this, and it was a very, very altruistic and self-sacrificing thing for Manning to do. In Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, again, hardcover edition, Lyle Stewart, copyright 1981, there's discussion of how the myth that Martin Bormann had died in World War II was floated for the world's press in the early 1970s. Heinrich Mueller here was the former, the Mueller here is Heinrich Mueller, the head of the Gestapo in World War II, a general in the SS, and the man who became the security director for the Bormann Group in the post-World War II period. His organization, utilizing the intelligence and putative capabilities of the SS, viewed by many as one of the top intelligence organizations in the world. What Mueller and the Gestapo did in order to make it appear as if Martin Bormann had died in World War II was to take a couple of concentration camp inmates who bore a physical resemblance to Martin Bormann. Hey, their dental work was altered to make it appear somewhat as though, to make it appear similar to Bormann's dental work. And then they were killed and their bodies placed at a couple of key places, not too far underground in the rubble of Berlin. And eventually, an SS man acting on Heinrich Mueller's orders alerted Stern magazine to these bodies, and it was Stern, owned by Bertelsmann, that floated the disinformation that Martin Bormann had died in Berlin. Turning to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, we read, "Yet under Mueller's skillful guidance, two bodies were planted. Their discovery was made possible when an SS man, acting on Mueller's orders, leaked the information to a Stern magazine editor as part of a ploy to, quote, prove, unquote, that Bormann had died in the Berlin freight yard. The stand-ins for Bormann were two unfortunates from concentration camp Sachsenhausen who had been killed gently in the Gestapo basement secret chambers with cyanide spray blown from a cigarette lighter, a killing device later allegedly used by the KGB in 1957 and 59 against Lev Rebet and Stefan Bandera, two leaders of the Ukrainian emigre in Munich. At Gestapo headquarters the night of April 30th, the bodies were taken by a special SS team to the freight yards near the Wiedendamm Bridge and buried not too deep beneath rubble in two different areas." So Bertelsmann's, one of the Bertelsmann's chief journalistic organs in Germany, Stern magazine, the periodical that floated the disinformation, courtesy of Heinrich Mueller and his SS, that Martin Bormann had died in the closing days of World War II. What we're going to do now is to take a look at the revisionist capabilities of Bertelsmann, and one of the reasons why I think this is such an important connection. We're going to begin by reviewing a section from For the Record segment 177, recorded in the fall of 1999. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience. This, again, is from the Nation's issue of November 8th of 1999. It can also be found on their website at thenation.com. By Hirsch Fischler and John Friedman, it's entitled Bertelsmann's Revisionist, and it's about a fellow named Dirk Bovendam, and that's Bovendam. And just who he is and the role he has played with Bertelsmann will become very clear. I want to stress as we relate, courtesy of Messrs. Fischler and Friedman, as we relate some of the titles and some of the obvious revisionist history that Bovendam has been engaging in, note the dates of his publications, because he has continued to write virulently pro-Nazi revisionism right up into the 1990s, and that overlaps his employment by Bertelsmann. This article reads, "On October 30th in Atlanta, the Anti-Defamation League, self-described as the world's leading organization against anti-Semitism, will honor the Bertelsmann Foundation. The foundation, which is closely linked to Bertelsmann AG, the global media empire and owner of Random House, Bantam, Doubleday, Dell, and others, will receive an award from the ADL's International, A World of Difference Institute. The award will specifically recognize Reinhard Mohn, the founder of the foundation, as well as a member of the founding family of the Bertelsmann firm. It is surprising that the ADL should so honor Bertelsmann at this time. Contrary to the company's official history, Bertelsmann cooperated with the Nazis in the late 30s and early 40s, publishing a range of Hitlerian propaganda. See Hirsch Fischler and John Friedman, Bertelsmann's Nazi Past, December 28, 1998. Current Bertelsmann activities raise more disturbing questions." By the way, before we get to the current activities of Bertelsmann and the very disturbing questions that they do indeed raise, bear in mind something that I noted in For the Record segments 122 and 123, namely that as the Nazis and the Third Reich prepared to go underground, as their military defeat on the battlefield approached, they were very careful to give anti-Nazi or ostensible anti-Nazi pedigrees to all of the individuals and institutions that they planned on having as major operatives in the post-World War II underground Reich. That appears to have gone for Bertelsmann as well as for the some of the other companies that the other companies involved with the Bormann Group. So bear in mind that the ostensible Bertelsmann opposition to Nazism and the Third Reich is not only not true, but is to be expected for any institution or individual that was to play an important part in the post-World War II underground Reich that I've spoken about. Back to this article, Bertelsmann's Revisionist, from the November 8, 1999 issue of The Nation. In 1980, Bertelsmann's Stern magazine published poems and illustrations supposedly written and drawn by Hitler during World War I under the title Rhymes by Private First Class H. Dirk Bavendam, B-A-V-E-N-D-A-M-M, a 61-year-old German historian who had been instrumental in helping Stern obtain the material, wrote an accompanying article noting that the poems and drawings show Hitler as an ordinary soldier. In one illustration, a German soldier gently holds a baby. In another, a soldier helps a mother lying in bed while a baby nestles in a cradle. Subsequently, the poems and drawings were determined to be forgeries. Later, Mohn gave the green light to a Bertelsmann division to purchase the Hitler diaries by the same forger, which also showed a milder Hitler. They were published in Stern in 1983. Bavendam's career was not affected. His book, Roosevelt's Way to War, was published in 1983. Note this, by the way, this book was published in 1983, entitled Roosevelt's Way to War. Rewriting history, he stated that Roosevelt, not Hitler, had caused World War II. He also wrote that American Jews, quote, controlled most of the media, unquote, and he claimed they gave a false picture of Hitler. Did the book impress Mohn, then the majority shareholder of Bertelsmann? The firm hired Bavendam as its house historian, and in 1984, by the way, this is well after the Stern magazine publishing poems by Hitler, which gave a nice fuzzy, soft glow to the personality of Hitler, and also after the notorious Hitler diaries were published by Stern, which also portrayed a milder Hitler, and also after the book Roosevelt's Way to War that blamed World War II on Roosevelt and said that American Jews controlled the media and that they gave a false picture of Hitler. After this, Bertelsmann hired Bavendam, as its house historian, beginning again with this last section. The firm hired Bavendam as its house historian, and in 1984 he completed an historical study, 150 years of Bertelsmann, the founders and their time, with a foreword by Mohn. A year later, Bavendam edited the firm's official history, which set forth the untrue story that the firm had resisted the Nazis and had been closed down by them. Mohn also asked Bavendam to write the authorized history of the Mohn family, spelled M-O-H-N, published in 1986 under the title Bertelsmann, Mohn, and Skippel, or Sippel, S-C-I-P-P-E-L, Three Families, One Company. In a second book, Roosevelt's War, published in 1993, reissued in 1998, Bavendam accuses the U.S. president of enacting a plan to start World War II. In the same book, he suggests that Hitler's threats in early 1939 against European Jewry were a reaction to Roosevelt's strategy against Germany. Again, this was published in 1993 and reissued in 1998. Continuing. And that, by the way, this another book blaming World War II on Roosevelt and suggesting that Hitler's threats in early 1939 against the Jews were simply a reaction to Roosevelt's plotting against Germany. Continuing with this article. After the revelations about Bertelsmann's Nazi past appeared, the company announced that it had asked, quote, the historian and publicist Dr. Dirk Bavendam to look at the new information and begin to reinvestigate the role the publishing house played in those days, unquote, and defended his work. This is a most recent defense. It also set up an independent commission to investigate Bertelsmann's World War II activities. The commission, chaired by Saul Friedlander, a history professor at UCLA, insisted that it could not continue unless Bavendam departed. Professor Friedlander said that he had read some of Bob and Dom's work, but he declined to categorize it. He noted that his objection was procedural rather than based on content. Quote, "We asked very firmly that we should be the only research entity, and Bertelsmann accepted our request immediately," unquote, he said. Bob and Dom said in an interview that he could not, quote, "remember exactly," unquote, what his role had been in the publication of the fake Hitler poems and drawings. Discussing Roosevelt and Hitler, he described his views as, quote, "nonconformist and independent," unquote. He added, again quoting, "All the world is under the impression that Hitler was in the main responsible for the outbreak of World War II. But I see it in a bigger framework of the United States moving to the status of a superpower," unquote. In other words, he's blaming World War II on Roosevelt and the United States, as he has done in two different titles. That did not deter Bertelsmann in any way from hiring him to clean up their historical past, or attempt to clean up their historical past. Continuing. A spokesperson for Bertelsmann said Bob and Dom is not now employed by Bertelsmann or any related entity, and that his affiliation with the firm, quote, "ended with the formation of the Independent Historical Commission," unquote. That would be within the last year, basically. Continuing, the spokesperson described the corporate history Bob and Dom wrote as, quote, "never intended to be a definitive scholarly corporate history of the company," unquote. Carol Stern LaRosa, head of the ADL's A World of Difference Institute, admitted there was, quote, "soul-searching," unquote, about the award. I would think there ought to be a whole lot more than just soul-searching. And in particular, you'd think ADL would be a lot more self-conscious after having been involved in the spying scandal in this country in the early 90s. And yours truly was among the targets of that particular spying scandal. And so I think that perhaps ADL would need to do a little more soul-searching under the circumstances in terms of some of the people they're targeting and in terms of some of the people that they're willing to honor. However, such is the road to ruin, as they say. Continuing, or beginning again with this section, Carol Stern LaRosa, head of the ADL's A World of Difference Institute, admitted there was soul-searching, unquote, about the award. Although the Bertelsmann Foundation donated about $1 million to the ADL for projects in Germany to promote democracy, human rights, and tolerance, she noted, quote, "it is their moral commitment we are honoring," unquote. She also pointed out that the award recognizes the current programs and leadership of the Bertelsmann Foundation and not the past activities of the company. Yet it is highly ironic that at the same ADL conference where the Bertelsmann Foundation is scheduled to receive its award, Emory University professor Deborah Lipstadt, L-I-P-S-T-A-D-T, will address the group on, quote, "the ever-growing danger of Holocaust revisionism," unquote. That again from For the Record segment 177, and that in turn from The Nation magazine of November 8th of 1999. Now, again, note the irony there that the very same conference, or the very same time that ADL was going to be honoring Bertelsmann, there was also an address warning about the dangers of Holocaust revisionism. One of the central figures in Holocaust revisionism is a fellow named Fred Luchter, who was an execution equipment expert who visited Auschwitz with a Nazi film crew, a neo-Nazi film crew, and provided disinformation that there had been no gassings at Auschwitz. There's a new documentary about Fred Luchter that was described in the Los Angeles Times of Saturday, January 1st of 2000. This particular article on the front page of the Style section, part two, is by Ellen Baskin, B-A-S-K-I-N. It's called On Death and Documentaries, subtitled Errol Morris was asked to help revise Oscar rules, but was too busy with his latest film to contribute much. The title of the documentary is Mr. Death, The Rise and Fall of Fred Luchter, last name L-E-U-C-H-T-E-R. And what's interesting about, well, there are a lot of things interesting, but after his initial cut of the documentary, which just showed Fred Luchter, the producer of the film, Errol Morris, had a very interesting experience at Harvard University, one of this country's top universities. Skipping down in this article, again from the LA Times of 1-1-2000, we read, Morris was caught by surprise after screening an early cut of Mr. Death for a class at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he lives. At that point, the only talking head in the film was Luchter's, and the students' reaction to his story came as a shock. Quote, there were members of the class who were convinced by Fred and started to wonder whether this ever happened, unquote, Morris recalls, again quoting, Then there was another group who knew better, who knew that the Holocaust had happened and wondered why I believed Luchter. Morris, who is Jewish, was very disturbed by the student's response. When some in the audience at Harvard, quote, which is supposed to be a good school, he notes, as a deadpan aside, began to believe Luchter, Morris realized that his film posed a larger question. Could I just make a movie with Fred Luchter alone? The answer is no, I could not. It would be irresponsible. The finished film includes commentary from historian Robert Jan Van Pelt, from Holocaust denier Zundel and David Irving, and from James Roth, the laboratory manager hired by Luchter to perform chemical analysis on the samples collected in Poland, who decisively repudiates all of Luchter's claims. But notice that in the initial cut of this film, which just showed Fred Luchter, when screened to an audience at Harvard University, a number of the students, a large chunk of them, began to believe Fred Luchter. That goes to the very core of my concerns about the German corporate control over American publishing, and note again the fundamentally revisionist attitude of Dirk Bovendam, Bertelsmann's House historian who blamed World War II on Roosevelt and the United States. That's why I find the book Serpent's Walk, the Nazi tract penned by someone who writes under the name of Randolph D. Calverhall, to be so significant. This book is about a takeover of the United States in the mid-21st century by the descendants of the SS who go underground, build up a huge financial organization, and buy into the American opinion-forming media. Reading from the back cover of Serpent's Walk, Serpent's Walk explores that possibility. It assumes that Hitler's warrior elite, the SS, didn't give up their struggle for a white world when they lost the Second World War. Instead, their survivors went underground and adopted some of the tactic of their enemies. They began building their economic muscle and buying into the opinion-forming media. A century after the war, they are ready to challenge the Democrats and Jews for the hearts and minds of white Americans. And once again, I'm going to reprise a section of Serpent's Walk I read before in a discussion between two of the Nazi faithful, one Wrench, who is an SS insider, and Lessing, who was a convert, in a discussion which, to a seasoned listener, would be quite obviously about the Bormann Organization, or the reality that is the Bormann Organization. We read, about 10 years ago, we swung a merger, a takeover, and got voting control of a supercorp that runs a small but significant chunk of the American media. Not openly with bands and trumpets or swastikas flying, but quietly. One huge corporation cuddling up to another one and gently munching it up like a great gubbing amoeba. Since then, we've been replacing executives, pushing somebody out here, bringing somebody else in there. We've swung program content around, too. Not much, but a little, so it won't show. We've cut down on nasty Nazi movies, good guys in white hats and bad guys in black SS hats, lovable Jews versus fiendish Germans, and we have media psychologists, ad agencies, and behavior modification specialists working on image changes. Hell, if you can con Granny into buying sugar turds instead of bran farts, then why can't you swing public opinion over to a cause as vital and important as ours? And then Lessing replies, hard to get people to love death camps. We don't try. You can't erase 100 years of lying propaganda overnight. We play those aspects down and stress the positive ones instead. The mystique, the scientific approach to racial genetics, the efficiency and organization, the dedication, and the heroism. People will buy that. Skipping down. How in hell do you expect me to believe this? All my life, all my parents' lives, everybody has taken the Holocaust for rock-solid truth. And then Wrench replies, some rocks are less solid than others. And skipping down again, Lessing replies, Wrench goes on to say, it's all how you package it. Opinion is a goddamn commodity. Impossible with the Nazis, Lessing replies. And then Wrench says, it works with anybody, skipping down. Give it time. Aside from the media, we've been buying up private schools and helping some public ones through philanthropic foundations, and working on the churches, and the born-agains. And noting the fundamentally revisionist stance of Dirk Bovendam, the House historian of Bertelsmann, and note again the response of a class at Harvard University, one of this country's elite schools, to the screening of the documentary Mr. Death, The Rise and Fall of Fred Luchter Jr., the original version of the film which just showed Fred Luchter convinced part of that class. And the implications of this for the next century couldn't be exaggerated. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.